If you think of an eating disorder like anorexia nervosa or bulimia or binge eating disorder, the picture in your mind might be that of a teenage girl or perhaps a boy. I've been wondering about those painfully skinny teenage boys fitting into those impossibly small hipster jeans lately. The thing is, eating disorders can hold adults captive too. You might have had that experience, perhaps for the first time or for a long time, in your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, older even. And this really isn't discussed enough. As you'll hear, people can find themselves overlooked or even demeaned by medical professionals when they have a midlife eating disorder. Clinical psychologist Cynthia Bulick is the Distinguished Professor of Eating Disorders at the University of North Carolina, where she heads up their Centre of Excellence for Eating Disorders. Her new book is very powerful indeed. It's called Midlife Eating Disorders, Your Journey to Recovery. Very practical. And I spoke with Cynthia about her book during her recent trip to Australia. Erase All Stereotypes, that's the title of your introduction to this book. Tell us what sorts of stereotypes and the impact they can have, particularly on adults.
You know, I think we're under this major misconception, as you mentioned, that eating disorders are the province of white, upper middle class, female adolescent girls. And that is a myth that we absolutely have to bust, because when you really look at the numbers, statistically, that's not the most common profile of someone who suffers from an eating disorder. It's actually a woman or even a man in their 30s or 40s with binge eating disorder.
Tell us then what, I mean, for example, binge eating disorder. Perhaps people don't know what that is. What are we talking about when we talk about eating disorders?
Yeah, great point and a really timely question. The American Psychiatric Association is coming out with their new sort of catalog of mental illnesses called the DSM-5. And binge eating disorder for the first time is really getting a home of its own. It's becoming a bona fide diagnosis. And what it is, it's the presence of binge eating, which is defined as eating an unusually large amount of food and feeling out of control, in the absence of purging behaviors like we see in bulimia, like vomiting or laxative abuse. So one of the side effects of binge eating disorder often is also weight gain. So you're dealing with two issues. You're dealing with weight dysregulation and you're dealing with binge eating.
Mm. Look, there's no simple story here and every person is different. But Cynthia, are there distinctions for adults in terms of how eating disorders are experienced in adulthood compared to adolescence?
You know, we're seeing the same patterns, you know, anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. But there are some interesting differences. And let me start by talking about sort of how do eating disorders arise in midlife? So we're sort of seeing three patterns. One of them is people who've had an eating disorder when they were an adolescent, and then they've either recovered or the symptoms have sort of smoldered for a while, and then something triggers it again in midlife, and they get a relapse or a reoccurrence of the eating disorder. Then there's this other group of people who have chronic eating disorders. So they've really been suffering all along, well into midlife.
With huge health impacts.
Oh, it's incredible. Mm. And, you know, that's something we really have to hit on a little bit later, just the impact of an eating disorder on a midlife body. And then the third group are people, it's a smaller group, but they're people who actually develop eating disorders for the first time in midlife. And again, usually in response to some stressor.
So just talk about those stresses, those triggers that can either reignite an eating disorder in midlife or cause someone to experience an eating disorder for the first time in their 30s, 40s and 50s?
Sure. So some of the ones that we've been seeing very commonly are interpersonal triggers. So something like a divorce or the loss of a loved one. You know, one very common scenario is someone who gets divorced and then they view themselves as being back on the market. So they go to extreme measures to change their physical appearance, usually an extreme diet. And that might be the first step down that slippery slope to an eating disorder. So there are interpersonal stressors. Sometimes illness or surgery can be a stressor. Loss of a job, so there are financial stressors, and really interesting, a biologically triggered one is menopause. So menopause, I mean, that's hormonal upheaval, as we all know, and that can often be something that can trigger an eating disorder in midlife.
Well, what are the psychological dynamics here, though? Because part of the story around eating disorders is that kind of that crazy sort of nexus between control and lack of control in our lives.
You know, it's interesting, and I think we often think about control issues, and I think that's sort of our explanatory model for what's going on. Mm. But we actually know that genes play a large role in all three of these eating disorders. And the way I like to look at it is genes load the gun and environment pulls the trigger. Mm. And then we try to understand it. And often our understanding is that psychological packaging of control. But what it often is many of these eating disorders are a way of regulating affect or emotion that's just out of control. So, for example, someone who's biologically predisposed to anorexia might find that starvation actually calms them. Whereas for the rest of us, starvation makes us nervous and anxious and irritable. So they respond biologically different to starvation than the rest of the population does.
So there's that interplay. For someone, for example, who might have experienced extreme stress at work or extreme stress in a relationship, what can an eating disorder do for them? I mean, why do they, in a sense, retreat to an eating disorder?
Sure, and this is going to differ across those three disorders. So as I mentioned, for anorexia, that might provide some sense of calm in an otherwise totally upheavaled life. Mm. For other people, binge eating can provide that temporary numbing of the stress and anxiety associated with whatever the conflict or stress is that are undergoing. I think if you look at the whole population, you see that people respond differently to stress in terms of how their appetite responds. When some people are stressed, they eat less, they can't eat at all. When some people are stressed, they might overeat. And for some people, stress doesn't impact their appetite. So it all depends on sort of which way you lean in terms of appetite and anxiety.
Cynthia, looking beyond the individual, though, momentarily, there is a bigger story here, and you tell it. And you write very powerfully about what you describe as a culture of discontent. Tell us what that cycle is that you're alluding to culturally that has an impact on our experience of eating disorders in adulthood.
Well, I really blame a lot of the big industries, and I blame big fashion, I blame big diet, and I blame this big cosmeceutical industry where you can't really tell if it's a pharmaceutical product or a cosmetic product. Mm. And what they've done is they've sort of changed their advertising strategy. Instead of having it be like keeping up with the Joneses, what they do is they plant these worms of discontent in your mind that you should be unhappy with your physical appearance, you should be unhappy with the process of aging. And, you know, it gets to you. It really gets under your skin. And then they tell you, they sell you this product or they present you with this surgery that somehow is going to miraculously remove that discontent. So it's a clever strategy. They make you feel badly about yourself and then they sell you something to make you feel better. And the problem is that engaging in some of those extreme behaviors can be the first step toward an eating disorder.
Yes, indeed. Cynthia Bulick is my guest this morning. She is Distinguished Professor of Eating Disorders, a unique title, at the University of North Carolina, where she heads up the Center of Excellence for Eating Disorders. Her new book is called Midlife Eating Disorders. So we're focusing on the experience of eating disorders in your 30s and your 40s and 50s, a very secret experience for many people. And Cynthia, I want to come to men, because I think increasingly we're understanding that boys and men can be very much afflicted with eating disorders. And this is a hidden story in clinics, in research, and in public.
Yeah, if I can be so bold, I will say that we have neglected men when it comes to eating disorders. And in part, that's because even our definitions of the disorders are built around what we've seen in women. So the questions we ask reflect how the disorders play out in females. So men sometimes are going for a different end. They might not be going toward thinness. They might be going toward decreasing their body fat or getting more ripped or looking at muscle definition or, as you said, fitting into those hipster jeans.
Yeah.
So we actually have to change the way we ask the questions in order to capture the way men express eating disorders. So that's really the first disservice that we've done.
Well, let's tease out the experience for men. And you will have met and worked with many, many men clinically.
Absolutely.
Their stories are very much hidden, aren't they?
Well, they are. And there's also a lot of shame associated with it. So, I mean, there's shame, period. Shame and stigma around eating disorders, which I really hope we can make go away, because I want people to feel as comfortable saying, you know, I'm dealing with bulimia, as they are saying I'm dealing with diabetes or I'm dealing with allergies. But for a guy to go to their GP and say, I think I'm suffering from an eating disorder, will often meet a response like, ah, you can't be, mate. That's a woman's disorder.
Yeah.
And then they just go further into the shadows because it's even more shameful. So we need some men to speak out and say, you know, I'm suffering from this and there's no shame associated with it. Get some help.
Really difficult, though, isn't it, for men themselves to acknowledge that they have an eating disorder when there is this assumption that most eating disorders are about bulimia or anorexia. And here you've got another dynamic sometimes for men around the kind of bulking up, you know, taking kind of hormone growth, you know, drugs, that kind of thing. It's another manifestation.
Well, that's right. And then, you know, it might actually start out in a healthy way, you know, desiring to lose weight and get more fit. But then it crosses that unhealthy line into an obsession where they can't put the brakes on. And you brought up a really important point that sometimes they might not see it. And it's really their partners who say, I think you're out of control here. You need to get yourself some help.
Partners. Let's come to partners. Partners suffer deeply. There's a lot of confusion and fear for partners who love and live with adults with eating disorders. What can happen to a relationship, but also to the dynamics of a family? Because, of course, food is so much part of the glue that sustains a family culture.
Absolutely. One of my patients said, you know, it's a little different for adults with eating disorders because there's so much collateral damage. And she was talking about the impact it had on her husband and the impact it had on her kids. And, you know, when you're treating youth with eating disorders, it's really important and fairly easy to bring the parents in for treatment. So you're doing family-based treatment, and that works. When you're 30 or 40, it's not so easy to bring your mom and dad in for treatment anymore. So we've really had to develop novel approaches to use the family to help adults recover. So we actually developed this new treatment called UCAN, which is Uniting Couples in the Treatment of Anorexia Nervosa, where we bring the partners in and they work together toward recovery. And I'm telling you, it's a powerful intervention. It's powerful for the patient because she or he gets more support, and it's powerful for the partner because they feel like they can make a difference and they have a blueprint for how they can help the patient recover.
Cynthia, take us inside some of the couples and perhaps families that you've worked with some really specific examples of how an eating disorder plays itself out in the family home, and I guess has family members kind of recoiling from the situation, not knowing what to do.
Yeah, you know, this one couple just comes to mind where the partner so loved the woman with an eating disorder. They've been together for over 18 years, but she was so paralyzed by anything that had to do with food. He took over all the cooking, all the shopping, all the food preparation for the kids, and he started neglecting his own health. He actually put on 50 pounds just trying to get her to eat with him. And then he couldn't exercise anymore because she became envious of the fact that he could do that. And so his health started to suffer. So what we see is the eating disorder basically is a wedge in between the partners. And what he said is you know, there aren't just two people in this relationship anymore. There are three. And, you know, our job was then to extract that eating disorder from the partnership so that they could be a couple again.
What lengths can people go in the home around food and avoiding it?
Oh, extreme lengths. I mean, when we had another couple, for example, who they hadn't eaten together for 8 years.
Yeah.
So, and he had no idea that she was hardly eating anything, and she was completely, completely separate from whatever his eating experience was. So they didn't have that normal couple experience of sitting down and sharing a meal for 8 years in their relationship.
And where do the kids fit into that dynamic?
Oh, you know, the kids, the parents, the mom or the dad who has the eating disorder often thinks the kids aren't aware, but children see everything. And this one mom said her kid came to her after she recovered and said, "Mom, every time you went into the hospital, I thought you were going to die." And she thought she was keeping it a secret from him. So, you know, as we all know, kids see a lot more than they let on.
Yeah, and the health impacts are very transparent too. I mean, people's teeth start falling out because they're vomiting all the time. You know, there are major, major health impacts in midlife.
Well, that gets back to that really important point. I mean, eating disorders wreak havoc on your body no matter what your age, and they really do affect every system in your body. But as we're aging and our bodies become even less resilient, it takes an even greater toll. So we're seeing more problems with the heart. We're seeing lots of problem with the digestive system. So we're seeing lots of acid reflux, lots of irritable bowel. We're seeing lots of problems with osteoporosis. So the bones are really suffering with people with anorexia nervosa in midlife. And as you mentioned, people don't think about it, but that stomach acid really does affect your teeth as well.
It does indeed. What about pregnancy? Because this is another realm that you cover in the book. And there are some devastating stories in this book of, for example, women who are frightened that their baby is going to be fat. So they come to the pregnancy with an eating disorder. They think the eating disorder is in effect going to cure them of the pregnancy is going to cure them of the eating disorder. But in fact, it can kind of manifest in really ugly ways during a pregnancy.
Well, it can. And I think the most important message of hope embedded in there is that we need to get people help before they get pregnant and while they're pregnant, not just if they have an active eating disorder, but if they've had an eating disorder in the past. Because you can have a healthy pregnancy if you have an eating disorder, but you need support. Because it is potentially very dangerous if you have an uncontrolled eating disorder during your pregnancy. And it can very much affect the birth outcome. So you can have a lower birth weight baby if you're not eating enough during pregnancy, and you can have other birth complications as well. So it really is finding a practitioner who can work with you during the pregnancy to give you the support that you need.
But it can be a disaster for your fertility as well, can't it?
Well, that's right. And, you know, one thing that people don't know, we did a big study in Norway, and we actually found that women with anorexia are much more likely to have unplanned pregnancies. So anorexia can stop your periods. And people think that if they're not having their periods, they're not ovulating. But often they might be. So they're still at risk for becoming pregnant. And the issue is, you know, when you're pregnant, the first sign is you miss your period. And then you start eating better and you take your folic acid and you do everything you're supposed to do. If you don't have that sign, you could be 3, 4, 5 months into your pregnancy before you even know you're pregnant and start taking those measures. So it's so important for us to, you know, to know that people with anorexia nervosa are sexually active, they are getting pregnant, and they need our support.
Yes, and I guess specialists need to know this too and need to have that conversation with women if they suspect an eating disorder, which is sometimes hard to pick up on. And I just think the story of Chloe was particularly tragic, and we won't go into her full story, but here she was being told to lose weight in order to, you know, before her pregnancy because she was overweight, and that had terrible consequences for her during her pregnancy.
Well, it does, and anyone who's been pregnant knows that the minute you go in for your antenatal exam, the first thing they do is they throw you on the scale, and it's not always the most sensitive clinical interaction, but it's a wonderful time where the nurse would be able to ask, you know, how are you feeling about the weight gain? Instead of just admonishing you about, you know, you gain too much, you gain too little, you need to do this, you need to do that. It's the perfect time to have a sensitive conversation, and you can pick up a lot just by asking that question.
Speaking of having sensitive conversations, at the end of your book, it's a very powerful chapter because you speak directly to people in the first person, to people with eating disorders. This is a chapter about recovery, and I guess recovery is as much about awareness as it is about action. But where do you start with adults, with a system that's often geared towards supporting young women who have eating disorders, not fully blown adult men and women?
You know, I tell people to, you know, take the book with you. Go to see your practitioner and say, this isn't just about youth and I need some help. And the first step, and it's a scary step, but the first step for anyone is to get a good clinical evaluation, because you just need to have a professional cast his or her eye over you and get some sense of what kind of an intervention you might need. And just stepping in for that first evaluation doesn't mean that you're going to need 5 years of psychotherapy. It might be a self-help book. It might be some sessions with a dietitian. It might be some medication, and it might be some psychotherapy. But until you get that eval, you don't really know what you need in order to get healthy.
Given that adults haven't, in a sense, had enough of a focus here, do we have good evidence around what therapies particularly work for adults with eating disorders?
For bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, it's pretty clear that cognitive behavioral therapy is really the treatment of choice. And this is the therapy that really goes in and looks at, you know, how unhealthy thoughts might perpetuate and, well, actually cause and perpetuate the disorder. And then it helps you change them and replace them with healthier thoughts. So that's really the treatment of choice. For anorexia nervosa, the literature is abysmal for adults with anorexia. So that's why we developed UCAN, because we're like, you know, we really need some better interventions from adults because we focused so much on how best to treat youth.
Just to finally, Cynthia, what's your reading of the Australian situation? Because I know people will be listening right across the nation this morning and thinking, this is me, what should I do, where do I go? And I was struck by the amount of research that you quoted from Australia in the book.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm impressed. Australia's amazing. And, you know, a lot of the work that's being done on the forefront of eating disorders treatment is being done here. And you also have a wonderful resource. The Butterfly Foundation is, it's a support organization for people with eating disorders and their loved ones. So, you know, I think Australia is very well positioned. And as long as they keep the momentum going, you know, in many ways, they're a model for the rest of the world about how to keep eating disorders in focus.
And I think just very briefly, you're doing a study that will involve Australians. What's that about?
Oh, that's right. We just got a wonderful grant from the Klarman Family Foundation, and it's called ANGIE, the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative. And it's a partnership between the University of North Carolina, QIMR, the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and Aarhus University in Denmark. And we're going to be looking for 8,000 women and girls to do a clinical interview and to donate a small blood sample so that we can do the largest genetic study of anorexia nervosa ever conducted.
Well, we'll put information on the Life Matters website about that. Look, thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters this morning with what I think is a very important and very pragmatic book for many people. So thank you, Cynthia.
Thanks for having me.
And Cynthia Bullock's book is called Midlife Eating Disorders, Your Journey to Recovery. Details on the Life Matters website. Cynthia is the Distinguished Professor of Eating Disorders at the University of North Carolina. She heads up their Centre of Excellence for Eating Disorders. And as I mentioned, we'll put the details of the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative on the Life Matters website. In fact, that's right there right now. You can participate. I gather it involves a questionnaire, and if you're eligible, then you provide a blood sample, and well, you're helping people understand, researchers better understand the experience of anorexia nervosa from the genetic perspective, which can be very powerful indeed. Hey, I want to tell you about a fantastic series that we're going to be bringing you every Thursday starting this week. It's presented by the wonderful Jane Caro. After 38 years with the same man, Jane got thinking, what is it about long-term relationships? How do they sustain? Are they all the same in terms of the recipe or ingredients that helps them sustain? So she, with Amanda Armstrong here at the network, has produced up For Better, For Worse. Six couples are going to be exploring this idea of how relationships sustain in a series of frank conversations with Jane. So that's starting this Thursday, and it's called For Better, For Worse. And the details of the series are on the Life Matters website with lots of extra information about the couples that you'll be hearing from. It's a real treat, that one. And I'd like to come to Michael Cathcart now. Michael.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
I know it's day two, but I wasn't here yesterday. Welcome back.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you.
Are there slides?
Oh, God, a slideshow. Beautiful photos, though. The Adriatic coast of Croatia. My God.
I'm so jealous.
It's really beautiful. Well,
send me at least, just send me at least one picture.
Okay.
Will you do that? Just one.
I will. Now, what are you up to today?
We're going to talk to Scott Barry Kaufman, who's a young psychologist associated with New York University, and he's got lots of theories about the psychological makeup of creative people. And I think it's got to do with being a bit contradictory. You know, this idea that you're an extrovert on stage and an introvert off stage.
Okay. You know. I wonder. I always find those sort of classifications. You can be creative and, you know, other-minded as well in the same body.
You can. Well, listen with a sceptical ear, Natasha, which is what we encourage here at Radio National.
Always. That's Books and Arts Daily coming up after the news with Michael Cathcart.
Don't forget those pictures.
I won't. We're looking at surrogacy laws on the show next, coming up to the news now on RN.